The Guardian.
Guardian Daily. News from The Guardian.
Hello, I'm Mike Duran with Guardian Daily for Monday, the 26th of May. On today's podcast, the end of Colombia's FARC rebels could be as its founder and commander-in-chief is confirmed dead.
He's a Scarlet Pimpernel-type legendary figure. He's been waging a war against the Colombian state for almost half a century. He's never really left the jungle.
And what took you so long? The cabinet finally come out for Gordon Brown.
David Miliband was out on Sunday saying that Gordon Brown was the right man to be Prime Minister last year. He's the right man to be Prime Minister this year.
Plus, down in Cannes, the Palme d'Or winner is... well, you just have to wait.
Guardian Daily from Guardian.co.uk.
Billions of pounds are being wasted paying industries in poor countries to reduce climate change emissions, according to two new analyses of the UN's leading carbon offset fund. Rich countries are massively overpaying developing countries under the Clean Development Mechanism, or CDM, when they needn't pay anything at all. The grants are there to help build new greener projects, but one study argues that nearly three-quarters of all registered CDM projects claim grants after they were completed. The Guardian's environment editor, John Vidal, explains.
Western governments, rich countries, have got to reduce their emissions enormously over the next 4 or 5 years. One of the mechanisms for doing this is to get developing countries, poorer countries, to do it for them. In other words, if China and India can invest in clean technologies which don't use that many emissions, money can go from the West to these governments as a kind of subsidy. And the theory is absolutely fine. 180 countries have agreed to this. The problem seems to be that the system is rather open to abuse.
The poorer countries are claiming that they're developing green projects, but they're not actually doing that.
Well, no, the projects are being built. The question mark is over the, what they call additionality. In other words, these projects are only available to get the cash from the West if they can prove that they would be additional to projects not being built at all. In other words, they have to show that these projects were only going to be built because of the UN cash available. Now, the trouble is that India and China especially have got huge policies in place which make it endemic on industry there to go down this clean tech route. So what these authors in Stanford University, one of the best universities in America, are arguing is that these projects would have been built anyway. They are not additional. In other words, we are subsidizing on an enormous basis the building of wind power, hydropower, all kinds of different technologies in China, and we're spending far too much money on it. And they say it's going to be billions.
One of the reports says that nearly three-quarters of the projects have actually been built, and then they're claiming the CDM grants after completion.
Absolutely. I mean, the theory is that these projects wouldn't get built without the CDM money, the Clean Development Mechanism money. But the projects get built and then they get the money later on. So there's all kinds of questions. Now, I have to say that the UN Clean Development Mechanism organizers and the British government, who are very, very supportive of this UN system, which was worked out by all these countries, deny absolutely. They say they've got fantastically good checks and balances and that they're all verified properly. The trouble is there's no way you can prove additionality. There's no way you can prove that something was going to get built without this money, because it is impossible, and the UN accepts that. So there is an element of trust in it. What the UN and the UK government says very, very strongly is that, no, these projects are well above board, they're very, very well verified and checked, and they are saving millions of tons of CO2 emissions.
So this money is still going to continue to pour in?
Well, the thing is that they've got absolutely no option, because this agreement lasts until 2012, when the new Kyoto Agreement should be signed. Until then, it's the only way that governments can meet their targets is by going to this Clean Development Mechanism and paying it money, giving them credits for the Chinese and for the Indians to, quote, reduce their emissions. But the argument on the other side is that this is actually additional to the emissions anyway. So you could argue it the other way around, and actually this is not saving carbon emissions at all. It is actually increasing them. America's not part of the scheme yet, probably will be in 2-3 years' time. Other countries are questioning whether to come in. On whether this works or not hangs an awful lot. The UN, again, to be fair, saying they're tightening up the process at every point. They really are. You know, they're learning as they go along. The trouble is these two reports make it very clear that the questions haven't yet been answered.
John Vidal. The Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC, has confirmed the death of its founder and commander, Manuel Marulanda. It's not the first time that reports of his demise have been issued, but until now, they've never been confirmed. Marulanda was in his late 70s and hasn't been seen in public for more than 5 years, as The Guardian's Latin America correspondent Rory Carroll has been telling us.
Yes, this time it's the real deal. After innumerable claims of his death over the last 15 years, this time it seems to have really happened. Firstly, the Colombia's government said that he died in late March, and we've just had confirmation from the rebels themselves, from the FARC, who said that Manuel sure shot Marulanda, died in the arms of his companion, surrounded by his bodyguards, on May 26th. They say that he died of a heart attack.
Why the obfuscation over the months and years towards his death? Why have we been told this before?
Because he's a Scarlet Pimpernel type legendary figure. He's been waging a war against the Colombian state for almost half a century. He founded the FARC. He's been a peasant leader, really been very, very seldom seen, very seldom giving interviews. He's never really left the jungle. So we've actually known very little about him. And for that reason, the Colombian government has been too keen over the years to try to claim that they finally killed him. The FARC, meantime, have been doing their best to retain the mystique of Marulanda, because he's this legendary, mystical figure within Colombia's revolutionary movements. And so that is why his death is such a big deal.
It is, as you say, the heaviest blow yet to what is Latin America's oldest insurgency.
That's right. And this is coming on the back of many other serious blows against the FARC. They've lost many senior and mid-ranking commanders to killings by the security forces, as well as desertions over the past several months. And now losing Marulanda, even though he was so old, he was 78 or some people say 80 years old, he was still very much in day-to-day command of the rebels, and he was also a unifying force among the different factions of the group. So now for a rebel movement that's already under pressure, his death is a really heavy, heavy blow.
So what does the future hold for the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia?
Well, a very good question. We think that they're going to be struggling to retain their cohesion because they're hemorrhaging recruits, and there's lots of desertions, they've lost a lot of territory, and they've now been forced into the margins of Colombia, onto the borders with Venezuela and Ecuador. And really, they're kind of surviving largely on cocaine trafficking and kidnap for ransom. And they've lost a lot of their ideological way. Their kind of Marxist peasant revolutionary roots have been blurred a long time ago. And they have very, very little popular support. So really, things are looking very, very bleak for the FARC.
Rory Carroll in Caracas. Also on The Guardian's website today, who's going to pay to rescue those pesky adventurers in Australia? Details on who doesn't want to pay at guardian.co.uk/world. Citi bonuses top £13 billion in the first quarter of 2008. To find out who's in the market for a new Ferrari, go to guardian.co.uk/business. And Peter Greenaway's plan to project his film on The Last Supper could be in The Last Chance Saloon. More at guardian.co.uk/culture. Next up, following the by-election results in Crewe and Nantwich, Labour backbenchers have been having a twitchy weekend. The pressure on the Prime Minister shows no sign of dying down anytime soon. There's plenty of advice flying around for Gordon Brown, of course, some he might even listen to. After some delay, the PM's cabinet colleagues have at last come rallying to his support. The Guardian's Nick Watt has been assessing the impact on the beleaguered incumbent at number 10.
It's interesting that in the immediate aftermath of what was a truly dreadful by-election result for the Labour Party, there were very few cabinet ministers who came out. There were a few. We had Harriet Harman and Ed Miliband who came out to defend the Prime Minister on Friday. But of course, those are two cabinet ministers who are particularly close to the Prime Minister. On Saturday, pretty much silence from those who one would see as Blairites. But on Sunday, they started to come out of the woodwork. And you had Alan Johnson, the Health Secretary, and David Miliband, particularly significantly the Foreign Secretary, coming out being very supportive of the Prime Minister. David Miliband is important because obviously he was possibly touted as a leadership contender last year. He decided not to run. He really is seen as the front runner. He's bright, he's young, he's doing terribly well as Foreign Secretary. If the Labour Party is concerned about the sort of the youth threat of David Cameron, then David Miliband is the person to take him on. But no, David Miliband was out on Sunday saying that Gordon Brown was the right man to be Prime Minister last year. He's the right man to be Prime Minister this year. So it looks like the Cabinet for the moment is rallying behind the Prime Minister. clearly, as we reported in The Guardian on Saturday, there is unease in the cabinet. There is a growing feeling in the cabinet that Gordon Brown probably is going to struggle to win the next general election, but there is no appetite to move him on, move him out. We're not in a sort of a 1990 style chuck Margaret Thatcher out of the window, the defenestration of Margaret Thatcher that happened in November 1990. I don't think we're in that sort of territory for Gordon Brown, but there is certainly a fear in the cabinet that he probably is not connecting with the good British people and will struggle to win the next election. If there were a contest, I think it would be down to David Miliband and Ed Balls, and that essentially would be a battle between Blairite David Miliband and Brownite Ed Balls.
There is plenty of advice, isn't there, for the Prime Minister. Margaret Beckett calling for a change of direction. We heard Lord Paul, a Labour donor, asking for a cabinet reshuffle. And on the other hand, John Prescott just says, well, don't worry, be happy, Gordon.
Yes, I mean, you do have to be careful about not doing panic measures. But I think there is one message that is coming through loud and clear. You heard it on the record from Margaret Beckett over the weekend. You're hearing it privately from cabinet ministers. And it is this. The Prime Minister's script is, this is a difficult economic situation we're in. And I, as a serious politician and as a successful Chancellor, am the man to lead Britain through it. And what a number of people are saying is, that's fine, excellent, good news, but we need more than that in the script. We need you personally empathising with people, and we need you personally showing that you have a way that is more than that in terms of how you connect with Middle Britain, because obviously general elections are won and lost on the centre ground.
Is there any sense of how Gordon Brown copes personally with questions over his ability to do the job?
I think this has been a very, very difficult period for Gordon Brown. He had to wait 10 years to become Prime Minister. You could even say he had to wait 13 years, because obviously there are some in his circle who feel that he was cruelly robbed of the Labour leadership by the scheming Tony Blair and Peter Mandelson way back in 1994. So he's waited a long time. He thinks that he is a more substantial figure than Tony Blair. And yet, when you look at it, Tony Blair had this extraordinary ability to get out of difficult situations, this extraordinary ability to sort of have an immediate change of tone in the House of Commons. He could be light, he could be dark. Gordon Brown can only do one shade, which is, I'm a serious man for serious times. So I think personally, he is finding it difficult, but he does believe that we are in really challenging economic times. This isn't a British problem, this is a global problem. And at the end of the day, it's in our interest to have the most successful Chancellor, well, you could probably say in British history, running the show in these difficult times. So yes, it's difficult. Yes, I think he is finding it tough getting criticism from people who he respects. But at the end of the day, his calculation at the moment is that he is the right man for these particular circumstances.
The Guardian's Nick Watt.
Hello, I'm Safraz Manzor, and Claire Armistead and I are podcasting from the Hay Festival with a daily Haycast. Recorded in The Guardian's House of Hay on the festival site, we're bringing together some of the best of Hay's festival authors. Here are some extracts from yesterday's Haycast, where we brought together Christopher Hitchens, Naomi Klein and George Monbiot.
We all know that George Bush unsigned America's signature on the Kyoto Protocol and said we're not having anything to do with it. But he didn't do nearly as much harm to the global effort to fight climate change as Al Gore did, because Al Gore wrecked the Kyoto Protocol for everyone. His lobbying in 1997 at Kyoto was what turned it into a completely ineffective instrument with very small targets, which were really just ways of preventing action from being taken in the industrialized countries.
And one of my favorite quotes from the disaster capitalism complex is from Richard Baker, a Republican congressman in the state of Louisiana, who said of the public housing projects in New Orleans, "We couldn't clean them out, but God did," after Katrina hit.
There's a real market for books attacking the supernatural and the superstitious, the parties of God and the hideous damage they're currently doing to civilization. But it's also an attack on the idea that faith is something that deserves respect, that the habit of privileging faith, and saying if someone can be called a man of faith, that's axiomatically a compliment.
George Monbiot, Naomi Klein and Christopher Hitchens at the Hay Festival. And you can listen to all our coverage from the Hay Festival at guardian.co.uk/haycast. Still to come, Cannes dishes out its highest prize. The winner of the Palme d'Or is announced. This is Guardian Daily. I'm Mike Duran. In China, Sichuan's suffering continues to play out in public around the world, with aftershocks and heavy rains hampering the relief effort. But 32 years ago, without the glare of the global media, one in four Tangshan residents were killed when an earthquake obliterated the region. After rebuilding its infrastructure, the city is now ranked 20th among China's 400-plus municipalities. Tanya Branigan visited Tangshan for The Guardian, and I asked her if there are any useful comparisons that could help Sichuan's victims.
I think there are actually really interesting comparisons to be drawn between the two. The quake which hit Tangshan was absolutely devastating. It killed about one in four of its populations. It completely flattened the city. So although it was actually slightly smaller in magnitude, it really was absolutely devastating. And the other difference, of course, is that it didn't have as much attention, and it just didn't have as much aid, either internally, because China was much poorer, or externally, because, of course, nobody outside the country really knew very much about what had happened, because China was so closed at the time.
And it took nearly 10 years, didn't it, to start the rebuilding seriously. That's not going to happen in Sichuan, is it?
Exactly. I mean, the authorities have made it very clear. They've already created this 70 billion yuan budget for reconstruction. They're talking about throwing up 1.5 million temporary homes. They're very, very keen to get construction underway. One of those who actually advised on the rebuilding of Tangshan is even suggesting that the sort of new cities could essentially be ready within the year or so. One obvious difference with Tangshan is that places won't be reconstructed on exactly the same sites necessarily. Tangshan was a very mineral-rich place. There was never any question that people would shift because it has very strong coal mines, it has a lot of oil. It was a very good place to have a city, and that's why Tangshan had in fact become such a sort of strong industrial base before it was hit. Now, in the case of Sichuan, it's slightly different in that although the areas in general will still be occupied, people don't want to move away. People seem to feel quite strongly, many of them, that they want to stay there. Somewhere like Beichuan, but the whole geography has actually changed. We've seen these mudslides and so forth, which have just wiped out villages. And so you can't necessarily build where there were buildings before. And so the authorities are saying that they'll move Beichuan, the county seat of Beichuan, but they are still intending to rebuild those homes and rebuild those communities. And of course, they'll do so much faster.
In your piece, you say fast cars gliding along the streets of Tangshan testify to insecurity as well as wealth. What do you mean by that?
Well, this is one of the really interesting things that you go there, which is that survivors will say to you they're really amazed by how well the city's been rebuilt, how it's thriving. Now, of course, much of that is from China's relatively recent economic boom. But even before that happened, really, Tangshan was put back on its feet. And visually, there aren't really very many reminders of the devastation that occurred. They've kept a few sites to show it. They have an earthquake memorial and so forth. What you can find as soon as you talk to people is that the memories are really very fresh, certainly brought back, I think, in the last couple of weeks by what they've seen on television from Sichuan. But also, as soon as you ask them any questions about what happened, it comes out very quickly. And so, for example, the local resident said to me, well, there's a reason there are lots of sort of expensive cars in this city. And yes, it's because we're quite wealthy and prosperous. But it's also because people don't like to save, because they think you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. We might as well spend while we can. It's really very, very immediate to people. I mean, one of the guys I spoke to said, you know, I can see it, even though it happened 30 years ago. I can remember everything I saw. I can remember the woman we tried to save and didn't save. And it's very, very fresh to them and very painful. And particularly so, of course, after the Sichuan quake.
Tanya Branigan in Beijing. And you can get the latest updates on the rescue mission on guardian.co.uk/China. Now, let's slip into something glamorous and hop on a luxury yacht for a trip down to Cannes, where the winner of the Palme d'Or has been announced. Zan Brooks was among the 4,000 journalists to attend the event. He joins us now. Let's keep the tension up on who won the Palme d'Or for a moment or so and start with maybe some British success.
Well, one for Britain, and considering how poorly Britain was represented in this year's festival, that's pretty good going. The Camera d'Or for the Best First Feature Film went to the artist Steve McQueen for his film Hunger, which was about the maize prison hunger strikers in the early 80s. This was a film that did cause a kind of genuine stir on the Croisette. People were very impressed with it. It's a very kind of stark, dark, poetic, chilling, but kind of with a real soul to it film. You know, this shows how artists are kind of moving into feature films. There was Julian Schnabel, who did very well recently with The Diving Bell and The Butterfly. And now Steve McQueen has kind of, you know, marked his territory.
Stark and dark, that's pretty much been the theme of the festival, hasn't it?
It's been quite a grueling festival. Cannes normally has it both ways. It normally has the kind of serious art house, high-minded, slightly rigorous, grueling films. But it also has a lot of, for want of a better word, sort of tat and ephemera and tackiness. It makes no bones about having those two elements kind of together at the festival. This year, the darkness kind of had the upper hand. It was quite a grueling festival. There was a lot of kind of very sort of harrowing social realist films, of hunger being just one of them, to the extent that Sean Penn, who's the jury president, was saying, you know, slightly ruefully, I just wish there'd been a few more comedies in competition. There weren't that many laughs around.
We've held off on the tension. One that was in the running for the Palme d'Or is the Steven Soderbergh film.
Che did win an award. It won the award for Best Actor for Benicio del Toro, who plays Guevara in the film, which is going to be split into two films eventually, but in Cannes it was playing in this enormous 4.5-hour epic, which I think scared a lot of people away. The Best Actress award went to Sandra Covellone, the Brazilian non-professional actress, for Walter Salles' film Lina de Paz, which is a great film. Another very harrowing film, but a great film at this year's festival. Also two Italian successes. Italy seems to have done very well at this year's festival, and two kind of mafia-flavoured films did very well. Il Divo by Paolo Sorrentino, about the Andreotti era of Italian politics, won the jury prize, and Gomorra, which was the real sensation of the festival in many ways, about the Neapolitan mafia, a real kind of expose of the grubbiness, the seediness, the kind of violence of the Neapolitan mafia, won the Grand Prix award, which is basically the kind of the runner-up award.
The Palme d'Or, who was the winner?
The Palme d'Or came out of nowhere, as often happens. People were tipping Gomorra to win it, but in the end, the winner was a French film called Entre les Murs, which means Between the Walls, but the British title is The Class, and it's a schoolroom drama by the French director Laurent Canté, who is really kind of one of the best directors around in France at the moment, but most people won't have heard of him. He did a film called Human Resources and another film called Time Out, which were really well acclaimed films. This played in the last couple of days at the festival, and its success has kind of caught a lot of people on the hop. This is the thing about Cannes, that sometimes a film that comes right at the end can kind of steal all the thunder, and that seems to have happened with Entre les Murs. It's based on the autobiographical novel by Francois Béjardeur, who stars in the film as a 30-something teacher. It's a tough tale of an inner-city school in Paris. I guess in keeping with the festival, in that it's kind of tough and gritty and dark, and yet it has a kind of inspirational uplift as well. And so, you know, that's probably a good enough way for this very downbeat festival to go out on a slight uplift.
Sam, thank you very much. That's your lot for today. Ian Chambers was your producer. I'm Mike Durant. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.